from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The human body is a data-producing machine. There's heart rate and respiration rate, blood pressure and blood sugar, levels of hydration and levels of oxygenation. Obtaining that data about yourself used to require a doctor's order and a visit to the lab, but no more. Today, all that data is as close as your smartphone and the latest health app. There are tiny devices and phone applications that can measure just about anything your body is up to, which is changing what we know about ourselves and potentially how we view the practice of medicine. Will a health app a day keep the doctor away? Our topic next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Do you know what your heart rate is at this moment? Your respiration rate? The number of steps you've taken this morning, or the calories you've consumed. You could, you just need the right app. Health apps can monitor all of that and more, how much alcohol you might have consumed, or what sort of airborne agents are present that might trigger an asthma attack. And that data has huge consequences, not only for your own health, but also for the healthcare profession. After all, you only see your doctor now and again, but your smartphone sees you all the time. So in this hour forum, we explore the world of health apps, what they mean for you and for healthcare itself. Joining us to do that, Gary Wolf, co-founder of The Quantified Self, which is a blog and online forum dedicated to talking about self-tracking devices. He's also a writer and contributing editor to Wired magazine. Gary, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us too is Dr. Jeff Ulgen. He's professor of medicine and chief of the Division of Cardiology at UCSF and is part of a research team that's just started a study using mobile technology to monitor and predict and treat heart disease. Jeff Ulgen, good morning.
Good morning.
And Asa Raskin joins us too. He is CEO and founder of Massive Health, which makes various products, including health apps that focus on healthcare. Asa, good morning.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
Happy to have you join us. So let's begin by talking about what you're wearing on your wrist right now, Gary Wolf. What is that and what does it do?
Okay, that's a Nike Fuel Band, and it's one of many devices that measure activity. It's just a little digital accelerometer, electromechanical accelerometer, and it figures out how much you move, from which they can guess at how many steps you're taking, how active you are, how much exercise you're getting.
And what does it do for you? Why wear it?
It has an interesting effect on me. I'm not sure I always believe the numbers. They always go up, so it doesn't tell me I'm taking less steps. Nonetheless, it serves to kind of remind me, to give me an excuse to do more of what I already want to do, which is get out and walk around. And I can look at it and I can say, wow, that number has been sort of static for a while. I think I'll take advantage of this little bit of information and move more.
So it's the kind of thing that it's just like if you're in training to run in a long distance race, you keep track of the number of miles you run. There's something about just the tracking of information that's reinforcing of behavior?
Well, for sure there is. And it also is a form of communication. So you can use that number to communicate with yourself, to communicate with other people. And that's one of the most interesting effects it has.
Jeff Ulgen, you've pulled out something that you're carrying with you. What is it and what does it tell you?
Well, so I have a bunch of things on here that mostly I use to play with to sort of understand what's possible. One of them is an EKG case that lets me get an EKG of myself or a patient or whatever and have it automatically transmitted to the cloud for analysis. There's things that can track heart rate just using the camera on your phone.
So let's stay with the EKG example for a moment. I think of that as being the kind of thing that you have to go to the doctor to go get and get a doctor's appointment, or you have to get in to see and costs X hundred dollars to get done. You tell me what it costs. So this replaces that?
No, it's unclear exactly what it replaces at this point, but In theory, it replaces monitors that we prescribe to people to diagnose intermittent heart rhythm problems.
And so what's the consequence of that? If I'm someone who you've previously diagnosed with some sort of heart ailment, what does that allow me to do and allow you to do?
Right. So it allows the person, in theory, to determine whether they're having an episode that's due to that arrhythmia rather than guessing. Because the monitors we prescribe now are limited for a month. Then they send it back, and oftentimes there's no real feedback in real time about it. So some arrhythmias, like atrial fibrillation, for example, is an intermittent thing, and it's sometimes a little hard to tell whether you're out of rhythm or in rhythm, and a quick check like that might be useful to determine.
So potentially that. This is the kind of thing that could prevent someone from having a serious heart episode by just being able to say, this looks a little concerning. I better take some sort of action.
To be determined. I mean, I think that's sort of the theory, and that's one of the reasons we've started our study, is really to determine whether these things can affect health outcomes, and that's a big question.
We'll return to that and some of the potential outcomes and concerns about where that will go. But Asa Raskin, tell us you're calling us from Africa, and so what are you tracking this morning? What are you wearing? What are you keeping track of on your travels?
So I'm wearing currently a similar device to the Nike Fuel. It's the Jawbone Up, which tracks similar things, inclusive of sleep, which for anyone that's traveled, you know, that jet lag is quite an issue. And it sort of tracks how far you go. And the one that I currently love most is that it lets me watch my short power naps and wakes me up at exactly the right time when I'm most alert. The things that make me excited, to go back to the previous example of heart rate with these devices, not only do I get that sentinel effect of being watched and the measurement effect, which is if I know that there's a number that represents me and I want to have that number increase, it's the sort of the heart of gamification, is that we're starting to get to a place where things like heart rate can be measured not just when you want to look at it, but all the time. There's really interesting research paper that came out of MIT last year that lets you use a webcam to measure heart rate, and that's, you know, any webcam on your computer. And so now you get, for free, with no new hardware, the ability to see your heart rate over the course of a day, know when you're starting to be stressed out. And this gives us data sets that are unprecedented in size, where across hundreds of thousands and millions of people, you start understanding physiological signals in a way you didn't before, which starts to push forward, not just for the individual, but at a system scale, what we know about people.
Asa Raskin, CEO and founder of Massive Health. Well, let's talk about both of those, what it teaches us and the potential that it has for changing the healthcare profession. One question that occurs to me, Gary Wolf, is that it's fine to be getting all this data, but what do we need to be trained to do to understand it? I mean, we're all fascinated by the technological aspects of this, but don't we also need to be smarter about what these apps actually are telling us?
That's the most interesting piece, I think. There's a kind of dream or a fantasy that's extant now in the technical world, which is simply by showing people a stream of data, you're going to get them closer to some kind of optimal state and solve some series of problems that everybody agrees are pressing. I don't think that's too believable. First of all, it's not clear what the optimal state is for a human being. So it's not like we're a system that can be tuned to some goal. And second, it's not clear that getting information, simply getting it, puts you closer to some state that you want to get to. But what I think is interesting is these are new experiences, almost new senses that we're building for ourselves. It's a stream of communication that's coming from us back to us. So what we're doing now is trying to understand how to speak this new language of personal data. It's as much a problem for artists and philosophers as it is for scientists. And so that's the dialogue there is very, very rich.
So tell me what it's teaching you. What are you taking from this data that's giving you a better understanding of who Gary Wolf is?
Well, there's a few things that I am especially interested in tracking right now, and one of them is my sleep. There's little accelerometer-based sleep trackers. You just set your phone on the mattress, and it gives you some pretty good sleep data. And one of the things that I've been fascinated to learn is that our subjective impression of how we're sleeping doesn't match the data that we're getting very well. And to me, it's interesting not only because I'm interested in sleep, but because it makes me question what other circumstances am I in where my subjective impression of my state is not – doesn't match the data that I can get about that state.
And both could be true, right? I mean, your subjective sense also has reality, even if the data doesn't necessarily coincide.
Exactly. So what I find interesting is developing a way to put the objective data into contact with the subjective data and understand myself using that broader array of information.
And Jeffrey Olgan, how do you begin to sort through all this as a physician, but also as a researcher who wants to collect all of this information so that we know more? But as Gary is suggesting, it's not always in equal connection to what people are thinking about.
Well, there's lots of reasons it might not be in connection. So one is whether the monitor that's measuring your sleep is actually accurate.
Yeah, right.
Right? And oftentimes your own sense of your sleep is maybe more accurate than a 99-cent app that you've downloaded. And one of the problems as a scientist and as a physician that I worry about is that the way these apps and sensors have come out, they've come out as consumer electronic things that engineers, mostly in Silicon Valley, said, I can build this. It's pretty cool. Therefore, it must be useful. But there's very little science and data behind accuracy and whether it really does affect behavior outside of people who are extremely motivated because they've downloaded it and let alone any health.
I want to get Asa Raskin's view on this question, but this is really interesting. So is this an unregulated arena? Are not many of these subject to FDA approval or how does that work?
So it depends a little bit. So with the exception of the EKG thing that I showed you, none of that is regulated by the FDA. The EKG is regulated by the FDA in part because the company that makes it has decided to try to sell it to physicians.
Yeah. And Asa Raskin, as someone who's in the business of making these as the CEO and founder of Massive Health, is there a lot of stuff out there where the words, you know, caveat emptor ought to apply?
Absolutely. We're in early stages. But I think that goes both ways. Let me give you one of the scary sort of bits of information that really launched me along the path of trying to use technology and design in healthcare, and that was that you can fairly accurately predict what a doctor will prescribe based on the year that they graduated medical school. There's a lot of social momentum that goes on with doctors, which is not to say that doctors aren't doing the right thing, but rather this is a standard sets of learnings that propagate through their community. So I'm going to make a bold claim that the doctor in 20 years is really a data scientist with fantastic bedside manners. So what do I mean by that? I'll draw an analogy to technology. In the early 1990s, to put up an e-commerce website took you a team of 20, 30 people, millions and millions of dollars worth of funding, a large infrastructure. Well, now that we're, 2013, our tools have progressed, and it can take one engineer with almost no funding to set up that same site. Does that engineer still have to have ingenuity and insight and skill? Absolutely, but that one engineer can do much more. I think as we move forward, technology has that power. Data enables doctors and data enables patients and, more importantly, data enables people to make better decisions and at a better and bigger scale. To give a very specific example of something that I've learned from data, make a simple app called the Eatery that lets people track their food, and it asks them a very simple question. It says, if you take a picture of your food, how healthy do you think it is? And then we ask, 10 other people in the community how healthy they think that food is. One of the things we discovered is that for me personally, if I wait an hour to eat, no matter what time of the day, that food healthiness decreases by 1.7%. So if you wait 2 hours to eat lunch, you're on average going to eat 4% worse. And that's not just true for me. That's true for people in San Francisco, in Tokyo, in Sao Paulo, around the world.
Issa Raskin, the CEO and founder of Massive Health. So let's spin this out a bit. And Jeffrey Olgan, you heard Issa Raskin's description that in time you'll be a data engineer with a great bedside manner. What is the future of this for your profession? Will this really alter the way in which you deliver medicine?
So I think it has that potential. And I put potential in capital letters because there's a lot of work between what we have now and the establishment of algorithms that can actually be helpful for that, determining methods to engage people to use these things. Again, right now it's a very select group of people who are highly motivated in the quantified self world to use these things. Is that scalable? And then there's the whole question of whether it truly affects health outcomes. And I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done between where we are now and getting to that point.
Jeffrey Olgan, professor of medicine and chief of the Division of Cardiology at UCSF, joining us along with Issa Raskin and Gary Wolfe, the co-founder of The Quantified Self. We welcome your contributions and thoughts on this topic. Are you using a health app right now? If so, which one? How do you find it as something that's useful? Do you find it as something that's problematic? What's your own experience with this? If you're a doctor, how are you dealing with this with patients in your practice? We'd love to hear your thoughts on this topic at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Gary Wolfe, has it changed your wearing the fuel band and the amount that you've, I know, thought about this? Has it changed the way in which you enter in your own relationship with your physician?
Well, I don't think it's affected my interactions with the healthcare industry or my physician too much because I don't suffer from a chronic disease. I'm not in a constant interaction with my physician. But it did have one significant effect, which I think is typical. I was diagnosed a few years ago with high blood pressure. And standard of care is to put people on blood pressure medication very quickly after that diagnosis. I was a little bit skeptical, as many people are, and I decided to start measuring my blood pressure, as many people do, several times a day. I learned a lot from doing it. For instance, I learned how labile my blood pressure is, how much it goes up and down. I also learned that I could affect my blood pressure through changes in what I did slowly over time, over many months. But the most important effect was in beginning to measure, my blood pressure became something that was sort of a process of communication and relation to my own health, as opposed to being some arcane signal that was then going to put me into a relationship of consuming a bit of healthcare that was prescribed to me. And I think many of the chronic things that people suffer from, in those cases of chronic conditions, people benefit from having a relationship of communication with their own body that's mediated by data. And that relationship of communication can open treatment options of which they may otherwise be unaware.
Jeff Olgan.
So that raises a really important question. So the relationship between high blood pressure and heart disease and stroke is from data where blood pressure is measured in a doctor's office once or twice, and it's very clear that if you're above a certain number in those measurements that you're at risk, which is why treatment is usually instituted pretty early.
Right.
We have no idea whatsoever what it means for people when they go out of the doctor's office and measure their blood pressure and if it's different. We don't know if that reduces risk, whether their risk is higher or just as high, or what parameters in this big data of blood pressure measurement and how that affects your risk. And that's why we're really interested in trying to figure that out.
It occurs to me a bit. Let me try this analogy out on you. It's a bit like polling. By that I mean you see your doctor, you know, on average maybe once every 6 months, let's say. Imagine a presidential campaign where you only had a poll that happened once every 6 months. You wouldn't know what in the world was going on. in this case, in a sense, Gary's got a poll going on all the time. It's like a daily tracking poll of what's going on with his blood pressure. So potentially, right, you have much greater knowledge of what really is going on with a patient.
Potentially, but again, we have to really emphasize this, and it may sound a little counterintuitive. Everything we know about real outcomes from these diseases that we treat that predict occurrence of worse disease like blood pressure and heart disease is based on the intermittent polling. And so we don't know whether collecting more data changes that or doesn't.
This is an important point. It's really subtle. Important. It's subtle because that means that even though that data looks very impoverished, it's actually the best data that exists as official information in medical practice. Now, to me, what that says, and I think what it says to many people who are, in a sense, consumers of medical care, is that official information in medical practice is woefully inadequate. Now, is the information we gather about ourselves any better? And I think that's a fair question to ask. We have to ask it both individually and as a society. However, most of us are not responsible for issuing proclamations about how other people should treat themselves. We're taking individual responsibility. And this is an important mental shift.
Let me get Asa Raskin's take on this discussion that we're having, and then we'll go to a break. But Asa, what do you make of this about the potential for more information, but Jeff Olgan's cautionary note that we don't necessarily know yet whether or not that's going to really provide us with something that will be helpful?
Sure. So, correct. Right now, the most verified data to outcome is absolutely what happens when you go in, take your data to the doctor's office. But I would argue, just like Nate Silver shows, that many of the polls that are taken by specific groups of people are skewed, and you have to take a much bigger view to be able to predict exactly what will happen. When you go into a doctor's office, you are rarely at your natural state. There's normally a little bit of anxiety there, especially if you know that something is wrong. Moving forward, we take all this data, we have to turn data into meaning and meaning into something actionable. Otherwise, that data is useless to the individual. We can really move that conversation forward. And of course, when your data set's large enough, you tie that back in to the data that we already know. Something we standard do is look at training data sets. So this is, I think, a question for the next 2 years and 5 years, as you go 10-year mark, 15-year mark, these are questions that have been long answered.
But it sounds like, in a way, what you're suggesting, to just push the poll analogy one beat more, is just as Nate Silver in the New York Times and others point out, you have to kind of amalgamate all of this data. You have to come up with a sort of poll of polls. Is that what you think in the end needs to happen, Jeff Olgan, that you need to collect all of it, assess what's valid, and figure out what collectively it tells you?
So that's exactly what we're doing in our study to answer that question. But I... until we have that data, I'm still skeptical because it's not like polling, right? You're taking a blood pressure machine that's well calibrated, that is of a different grade, and while the data is woefully inadequate in terms of what we could potentially collect, it is nonetheless very rigorously studied with hard outcomes. And that's the piece we need to make sure we collect in all of this.
And we'll come back and talk more about that. And we also want to hear from you. What health apps are you using? What do you think they give you? What concerns do you have about what they're giving you? 866-733-6786 is our number. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts or questions on our Facebook page or our website. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, self-tracking health devices, so-called health apps, what they can tell you and teach you about what your body is up to, what we ought to pay attention to, and what perhaps we ought to be cautious about in terms of the information that we're gathering. We're joined by Gary Wolf, co-founder of The Quantified Self, an online forum dedicated to talking about these devices, also a writer and contributing editor to Wired magazine. Jeffrey Olgan, professor of medicine and chief of the Division of Cardiology at UCSF, and Asa Raskin, CEO and founder of Massive Health, which makes products including health apps. And we would like you to join us, too, at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. We were talking right before the break about this cautionary feeling that you have, Jeff Olgan, about yes, it's true, you only see a doc now and again, and that might not give you all the data, but it's data that we can count on.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And again, I want to be clear. I think that there's a lot of excitement around the potential for external sensors and apps to collect big data so that we can understand things in a way that we don't currently understand. I think that is important. But it shouldn't until the science is there, it shouldn't supplant kind of what we already know that dictates our medical and health behavior.
And how do we bring that together, Gary Wolf, so that the whole becomes more than just separate parts?
Well, the piece I would add to that is we're seeing a major cultural shift in which data moves from being something that is an asset in the hands of experts to something that we all have access to. And that cultural shift can break the knowledge system that we live in, so that when somebody says, look, there's peer-reviewed research published in credible journals that tells you if you get a single blood pressure measurement, you ought to be on one of these medications. That statement, which is a statement that sort of pretends to be a fact, is a statement that's constructed by a process of making knowledge, which may not be relevant when all of this data comes together. So what I'm interested in is helping people make that cultural shift so that their data is something that they can work with. And I know that there will be tremendous tension in making that shift because you can't break a knowledge system and replace it with something that doesn't exist yet.
So I completely agree with that. The key part to there, though, is that to break that knowledge system, and this is just science, right? That always happens. We were able to do things we couldn't do before. We gain new knowledge and we change paradigms. But the really important aspect of that is that break in knowledge has to be done in a way that validates an effect of this.
And Asa Raskin, is it your view then, though, that the point of all of this is that there can't be just certain experts that have the degree that Jeff Olgan has, that expertise is something that ought to be more broadly shared?
So I think that's a part of it. I think there's what Gary said about a cultural shift is exactly right. That the revolution sort of starts when a person comes in with their phone with data on it and slides it across the table to the doctor, who then makes decisions on it. And that revolution has already started. I think medicine, as it stands now, is struggling with the idea of people's bodies being unique and physiologically complex, and the study sizes that we often use are small. They're 10 people, 100 people, sometimes 1,000, rarely tens of thousands. So let me give an example where the old medical system really breaks down, and this new style of more consumer-driven not so much trickle-down health, as I call it, but sort of bottom-up health, takes over. And this is an example of James Lange's work, who does all the seminal research into the phenomenological ways of, say, determining whether someone is drunk. And he set out to research a new drug that's popping up all over college campuses called Salvia divinorum. And it's very difficult to do large-scale studies of psychological drugs because the fit where you do it and what circumstance you do it in deeply affect your experience. Plus, they didn't know whether this drug was safe or not, so how do you get it past your ethics review board? What he did, I think, revolutionary, and that is he said, I know that this drug is short-acting, that It has these effects on respiratory rate. Why do I know this? Because I've seen people do it on YouTube. And he did what every great professor does, which is says, I'm going to have my grad students watch thousands of them. And he did. And they coded up the results, how long people held in the breath, what the effects on the brain were based on what they were saying and what people around them said. And for the first time, he could study a drug in context, how it's actually used, got it, you know, into a peer-reviewed publishing system. And for the first time in his life, he had Harvard, who was trying to do a similar study at a much smaller scale, call him and said, this is fantastic work. This, to me, points to a new way of doing some of the science we've done before in medicine, but cheaper and at a much broader scale, because this is people releasing their own data into a common pool of knowledge, even though they didn't know that they were doing it for science
and
at
Jeff,
the time.
And Jeff Hogan, does that scare the bejesus out of you or excite you hugely?
No, I completely agree. And in fact, that's why we're doing the Health eHeart study, and that's precisely the model behind it. We're using mobile technology to collect big data on hopefully a million people to answer exactly that and to try to look at the individual variation that we've never been able to study before because, you know, a 4,000-person study is a large one in the current. So we've spent the last year changing and developing our research infrastructure to do just that, and we're about to release
that. It's fascinating when you think of things like drug trials, which often have a fairly small number of people involved with them that determine whether or not a drug is efficacious or not. It could completely change all
that's
of that, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Gary Wolf, you wanted to add?
Yes, I just wanted to say that the science that we're talking about now is one form of human reasoning and a valuable form. What interests me about these apps and tools is something different, though. It's can we extend human reasoning and develop criteria for validity which don't depend on aggregating tremendous amounts of data from thousands of people, which is then analyzed by experts and processed into statements about what everybody should do. I'm not saying that's not useful. I'm saying that that's just one form of human reasoning, and collecting data about yourself, getting a baseline, learning how to analyze that data, learning how to be more accurate in your measurements of what you're experiencing and feeling is also a form of reasoning. And the thing I would compare it to, many people who have diabetes have been doing this for years. Some of what they do is quite scientific. Some of what they do is quite intuitive. And they use data to train their intuition such that they can develop an individualized practice in service of their well-being. That's a new kind of reason.
And so the consequence then can be both intensely personal, but could also be gathered together and used in different ways. But they're two different possibilities.
Right.
Let's hear what our listeners are thinking about this question. Rick in Palo Alto joins us first. Rick, get us started.
Yeah, as a practicing data geek, I guess I would have to say that my preference almost always is to have a massive amount of data that may have a little bit of noise, you know, as long as the noise isn't too egregious, as compared to a small amount of quality data, just to weigh in on the debate, you know, of scientific research versus quantified self, and especially with health where there are just so many features that you're measuring, you know, you need large data or there's going to be combinations of those features that you measure that you're going to miss in clinical studies, I think. So you need the big data to see all of these various combinations in order to really make the kind of predictions you want to predict. So my bias is for huge data that might have some noise.
Okay, Rick, thanks. Jeff Hogan.
So I agree. My only comment earlier about that was that our current knowledge base that determines treatment is based on the former. So until we have big data to analyze and understand the implications of it, I don't think we're quite ready yet to alter therapies based on that.
But it doesn't discount it doesn't discount Gary Wolf's point, though, either, though, right? That you may not know enough to make sort of big global pronouncements about one kind of treatment or another. But if you're really dialed into yourself and you know and you're collecting this data and you know with your particular condition you'll do better if you do X in terms of sleep or Y in terms of alcohol consumption, that's still – I mean it's valid for you. It's only a sample size of one, but that sample size, if it's you, is important.
Absolutely. As long as we don't extrapolate that then to – and health outcome. So he had raised earlier the issue of blood pressure. We don't know whether everything he did that showed that his blood pressure was a little bit lower on the monitor is going to eventually affect his risk of developing heart disease. We just don't know because we don't have that data. And that was really my only point. But I agree. The more data we have, the more we're going to learn and the better we're going to be able to do.
Joy in San Jose is next. Joy, you're on.
Hi. I'm Joy, and I actually use two apps that have helped me quite a bit. I use one to monitor my blood pressure. I have high blood pressure for quite a few years now, and it not only reminds me to take my medication, but it also allows me to export an Excel spreadsheet that I can bring to my doctor so he can see how I'm doing. I take it about three times a week. I don't take it every day. But the biggest impact for me was I chose a running app that my brother told me about. I hadn't run for at least 10 years, and he got me on this couch potato to 5K. All I intended to do was walk and do a little bit of running, and it got me so enthused and proud of the fact that I could continue to run and make as much progress as I did that I was up to way beyond 5K running and doing it at least three times a week with some friends in my neighborhood. So that really worked as a motivator and as a good training plan that helped me get back in shape without hurting myself.
Joy, thanks. Thanks for adding that in. Asa Raskin, you wanted to hop in on that part of our conversation too.
Sure. I think that's a beautiful story and shows, I think, the power, the necessary power of consumer in healthcare. Because it takes something that used to be sort of yucky and turns it into something that you want to do. The thing before is that there's this idea of trickle-down health, where we make products that the people that use it don't ever get to choose. It's your insurance company or your doctors that's choosing for you, and they're not the people that have to use it. So is it any wonder that you don't like using them? When you go the consumer route, the very first thing that you have to do is make a product that people love to use. And if you can make a product that people love to use, then you earn the right to help them change the behavior in the way that they want. And we start to see that people talk in lauded terms about the products that they use, and they're passionate about it. They form communities. We've seen a major shift, a tidal shift in our society towards sharing. We've seen Facebook take off and connect more people than have ever been connected before. We've seen Instagram climb its number of users faster than any product ever has. This same kind of sharing and shift also more slowly is going to happen in medicine. Right now we're starting to see those models emerge in things like Runkeeper and emerge in things like Couch to 5K, slowly emerging in diabetes. It's a hard model to get because people don't like to share, say, their weight, their age, or some of the more complicated complications. But at the same time, when you can connect with people that are similar to you and that can help you through something that you need to get through, that's when it becomes an incredibly powerful tool that the medical institutions haven't yet fully latched into.
Joy, thanks so much for the call and raising that point. I'm interested, though, in sort of who's using it. What do we know about that, Gary Wolf or Jeff Olgan? Because, well, as Asa suggests, there's lots of sharing going on. I'm wondering if it's all sharing among a certain demographic and whether or not there's a sort of democracy of health apps that's taking place.
So I don't have any data on it, but it, in talking to people, my sense is that it is, the higher middle class folks, not low socioeconomic class people. I think there's probably a pre-selection for people that are highly motivated to do things in general. And one of the big questions I have is whether the engagement that the previous caller sort of talked about how sustainable that is across the board for people. The data for most of these apps is that there's high engagement early on, mm-hmm. and then it sort of trickles down pretty quickly. So,
but and if your assessment is correct that it's used by a certain strata of people, wouldn't that also have huge research implications? Because you're really it's like only going back to polling, you're only polling a certain percentage of the population.
Yeah, but that's changing very very rapidly. I mean, if you just look at the burst in smartphone use across different demographics. That's just where it is today. But in 6 months, it's you know can continue to grow and be much more widespread.
Keegan in Cupertino joins us next. Go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Keegan Juchitam. I'm a family doctor from Cupertino, practice in the Bay Area, and I have a lot of engineers coming to me with their heart rates and their blood pressures. On their iPhones, and you know, I love their motivation and you know wanting to be healthy and tracking these things, but I'm very hesitant about putting that data in the EMR and
CMR meaning record. Sorry
EMR
EMR being the electronic medical record that we have.
I see. Yeah.
It's I mean if you think about it, 5,000 data points of a heart rate of a healthy individual, maybe a 40-year-old guy who's wanting to get active again. There's going to be noise in there that when we put it in the chart, we are signing up on it saying we have reviewed it and that we have made appropriate medical decisions based on this on these measurements. But when there's no data behind it, it's very hard to do the chart to keep records of it.
We're losing you on your cell connection, I think, Keegan. But thanks so much for raising that really interesting and important question. That's precisely what you're trying to figure out, right, Jeff?
Yeah,
Logan?
That's why we're doing this large study. Because we do think there's a rich data set. We do think we'll learn more. And we're very interested to figure out how it can change healthcare.
And could it also potentially change, you know, malpractice is always the great worry of any doc. Do you have to worry about that with this, that you might make a prescribe something or make a diagnosis about something about data that you can't really necessarily count on?
I think that's possible. I think if we sort of let malpractice and sort of that fear drive how we react to this, we'll be in big trouble.
We won't
trouble.
Make a lot of progress.
Yeah, we won't make
Gary
a lot
Wolf.
Of progress.
I think there's a question that naturally comes up, which is where does the data belong? Where's the locus of control and where's the locus of meaning and who gets to ask the questions? And because it's data, we're used to thinking that it belongs in the hands of an expert. So that data ought to be in an electronic medical record and my doctor ought to have it all. But doctors do a lot with unofficial data. You go in, a doctor might say, "How are you doing?" And you tell them how you're doing. And this whole language that you use to communicate is not sort of all contained in the electronic medical record. It's you bringing in your state and the doctor doing what they can with your report. And I think we'll see personal data will reside with the person. And the locus of meaning will be primarily with the person. And the doctor will engage it as they can.
So is the potential perhaps in some ways not so much I've got all this data points to be entered into the electronic medical record – but that when you go see your physician, you're just that much smarter about who you are, and you can convey that in some sort of collective sense as opposed to necessarily in numbers and decimal points.
And the doctor different doctors will react to that differently. Some doctors, for instance, are able to take a person's family situation into account when they talk with them. They are able to say, this is a person with a bunch of kids, and that affects what they're able to do in terms of their treatment plan. And this is some doctors, they're not that interested in what your family situation is. And I think the same is going to be with our
There's data. A cultural shift that's also happening in the medical profession, which is that part of the healthcare reform bill was this big segment about electronic medical records. And what's going to happen, or at least what I think is going to happen and what most of the people in the field think is going to happen, is that there's going to be a shift from who owns your patient's electronic medical record from the physician owned to the patient actually owns their EMR. And it's a very big cultural shift that I think is important to happen and likely will happen.
Let me read a couple of comments coming in on email and on our website. Ruth writes, I was diagnosed with high blood pressure 2 years ago, tried using a health app to monitor my blood pressure, collected a lot of data. However, when I brought that into my doctor's office, we compared it with their readings, and my device was inaccurate. So there isn't much point in putting dicey data into the system. Bert says, my experience is that I've had an interest in my health data since I was 30. I'm now 74. I have a 44-year record of blood pressure, cholesterol, heart rate, etc. I used to keep it all in line. I use it to set goals. So that's the way in which he uses it. Bob writes, I exited the freeway as your program came on to pick up a Nike fuel band at the Corte Madera Apple store. I've been using an app called Simple that does a very good job of tracking systems. I've used it to track shoulder pain. It gives me a daily reminder to do tracking. I don't know if we want to be in the business of selling more Nike fuel bands, but thank you, Bob.
They don't need that much help.
Bernadette writes, I've been a smoker since I was a teenager. I've tried many times to quit. I'm now 35 and quitting again, this time enlisting the help of a great app called Cessation Nation. Every day I open the app to check on how much money I've saved and how many cigarettes I haven't smoked and the positive physiological effects occurring, such as physical dependency on nicotine, so forth and so on. It makes quitting actually fun. And let's go to Brian in Berkeley. Brian, go ahead.
Oh, greetings. I just want to talk about experience with having my health, blood pressure measured. When you talked about experts being the ones who get better data, one of your guests was talking about, that's been the opposite of my experience. When I was a student at Berkeley quite a while ago at the Tang Health Center, the doctor told me that if you take blood pressure at elevate the arm to heart level and let it rest for a couple minutes, you get a much more accurate reading. And when he took the time to do that, and he showed me that when he would take it quickly, not doing that, that my blood pressure was greatly elevated. So what I've learned over the many, many years since then is that when I go into a doctor or clinic's office, they rarely have the time to do that. The doctor does not take the blood pressure. It's usually someone else. It's usually a woman, often small of stature. I'm a large man, and my blood pressure is often elevated.
Yeah, so, Brian, thank you. Interesting. I want to get Jeff Olgan's response.
So I actually didn't I wasn't suggesting that you get better readings with experts. I was suggesting the following, that there's no regulation currently over the apps and other tools to measure them outside of the physician's office. So there may be variability. We just don't know. We don't know the accuracy. But the more important point is that there's no outcome science to know what to do with those measurements outside of the doctor's office. That's not to say that we're entirely accurate with our current outcomes. We just don't know what to make of 500 blood pressure readings that are normal or near normal when, you know, 30 in the doctor's office is elevated.
And Asa Raskin, why don't you weigh in too on this question of expertise?
Sure. So I think the big change here, because we'll answer these questions the next 2-5 years about how our data sort of integrates. But what comes first is no longer is going to the doctor's office a one-way communication. It now becomes a dialogue. You come in with data, and there's a conversation that happens about you, what's going on outside when the doctor can't see you, and your memory isn't the gating factor here. So we start to see a shift, and when you have advocacy over your own health, you generally make better decisions. Again, around expertise, one of the best ways and most of the really great sort of interventions around diabetes revolves around getting people into groups with their peers. And it's great not only for motivation, but all of those little things you do throughout the day. Well, your doc who might not live with that disease, they might not know it as intimately as a set of your peers. And we see that when you put a person who suffers with diabetes into their peer group, they get often better answers. And that's, I think, that's already known, but it's a precursor to the kind of shift in expertise from sort of a top-down system to a more peer-to-peer system, even if it's mediated in appropriate ways.
Which takes us back to the point you were making earlier, really, Gary Wolf. So there really are two ways to look at this. That this data has enormous potential, but we don't really know what that will tell us collectively because of the issues Jeff has raised. But it can also really change the way in which you learn and see yourself. And that data set of one has enormous impact for you.
Right. And I think what we've been talking about today is the effect of quantified self data on medicine. And I think there are stresses and strains there which are the same as the stresses and strains in other areas of expertise that are faced with this deluge of personal data and with this change of the locus of meaning from the expert system to the individual in governance, in education, in civic life, in medicine. In all of these areas, the expert systems which have had responsibility for data are encountering larger and larger groups of people who collect data for themselves. It's a very fascinating transformation, and there will be a lot of stress.
So fast forward, jump ahead a few years from now. Where do you think this will go? What are you intrigued with continuing to track in terms of this particular trend?
Well, I think the big questions are cultural questions. What can we learn and how do we learn it? And what are the systems for producing knowledge that we build based on our ability to collect data? So I think it's not just the gadgets. It's not just the new sensors, of which there are many, that will be getting information off our muscles, off our brains, from our mental state. It's how do we create a way to talk about that data, to make meaning from it, and to produce some of the effects that we want to see in the world.
And Azar Raskin, a very quick last thought from you on what intrigues you most.
So again, I think the doctor of the future is a data scientist with bedside manner, but the reverse goes for people. That no longer will the medical institution be sort of think of the patients only when they come in, but as people as a whole. And that's the major shift we're going to see, that the rise of the consumer is going to power much of the future of how we think about health.
And Jeff Olgan, last thought.
So I think there's great potential for these inexpensive technologies to create the ability to give patients a healthometer, a very quick way to assess their own level of health and cut down on waste in the healthcare so that only those that really need to seek attention, or if they have a chronic disease, a notification that it's deteriorating at a point that they need to see. So kind of what the banking industry has done with fraud detection. Can we, you know, alert people to problems ahead of time?
Jeff Olgan, thanks so much for being part of our program. Thanks, too, to Azar Raskin, CEO and co-founder of Massive Health, and Gary Wolf, the co-founder of The Quantified Self. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Amanda Stupai is our engagement producer. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Dan Zoll, our senior editor. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.